Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Everything has been geared towards finding happiness. If you're not happy, then something is wrong. Take a class, take a pill, read a book. Happiness is what matters most. It's become a cult, rejecting all other states of mind. The perfect still water, allowing ruling forces to fester and spread. All the while we smile, submitting to a lukewarm dream. The happy stay stagnant. The happy don't speak out or revolt. Happy can't be our starting point. Happiness is created, not found. Being sad, enraged, resentful, especially right now, is appropriate. It's needed. Allow yourself to feel everything. Torment, anger, despair. This is what fuels passion and change. This is what makes us exceptional.
Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast 4.0. Today is March 15th. Never forget. Okay? Anyway, really excited to welcome back Julia Turgianskaya to the show. Julia is the creator of the Brave the World YouTube channel. Julia and I have had several interesting and inspiring private conversations about the very theme we're delving into this month, the creative pursuit. I thought I would record one of them for you. And in what you're going to hear today, we deal primarily with the question of inspiration. How do you find it? Where does it come from? Stay tuned. Julia's life as an artist extends far beyond her work on YouTube, so we will discuss that as well. Coming also this week, another episode with Julia where we will talk about self-censorship and self-critique. So hot dog, y'all, let's get right to it. Today's podcast is actually composed of two separate segments. They are the bookends of what you're going to hear in the next show, and I will put a little dink in there so you know when one ends and the other begins. Thanks for listening. Here we go. So, you are an artist, an activist, a YouTuber, a writer. Do you like the term YouTuber?
I feel like I don't get enough views to be a YouTuber yet.
How do you describe yourself? Would you say, I'm Julia, I'm a blank?
The things that I do have always one intention, and it's to disenfranchise people from assumed power structures, from assumed narratives.
I'm really happy that you are the first guest in a brand new theme. What we've been doing in 2016 is we do a theme every month. So in January, we did productivity. That's an important one. In February, we did a series called The Principles of Learning Anything. And in March, we're doing The Creative Pursuit. It started for me as this frequent thought. It occurs more than I would like it to occur, where I wake up or I go to work and I say, shit, I think I'm out of ideas. And I'm trying to remedy that by having talks this month with people who have inspired me or who I've enjoyed working with or whose work I have admired in the past. And you are certainly one of those people, in addition to being one of my pals. So I'm happy to have you here. And I wanted to talk about, you know, your past and your process and how you apply yourself to a certain type of work. So that's what we're going to do today. And ultimately, I think we will address that concern that I had about kind of feeling like there are some limitations going forward when it comes to doing some type of creative work.
Yeah, and I think it's important to look at other people's creative process in order to kind of wrap your head around your own, especially when you're feeling the way you've described your feeling.
Absolutely. So for people who are unfamiliar with you, what do you do and what have you done in the realm of, you know, media arts or production or other types of creative pursuits?
So I've done several things. I cover events or occurrences that I think are important with my own twists. So I guess the thing I'm known most for in that realm is covering the Ross Ulbricht Silk Road trial. Mm-hmm. So I guess I could be interpreted as somewhat of a alternative reporter. I make artistic videos. I'll write a script and then I'll recite it into the camera and I'll edit it and I'll make a artistic video, which also presents my criticism of the current world in a poetic way. So some people really are drawn to that. And we talked about my video last time I was on the show. We talked about the shift. So that would be probably the most artistic because it's one of my only videos that's composited out of clips. I also do just social reaction and commentary, political reaction and commentary in videos. And sometimes they're funny. Sometimes they're quite serious. So I keep myself busy. It's always fun. It's always interesting. And it's nice to have those different facets of work because you can't always be inspired and feeling incredibly creative to create the more artistic work. And there isn't always something going on that you're incredibly interested in, enough to, you know, bus to New York every weekend. So it's a good balance to have. And not everyone has that. And everyone is able to go into different directions at different points in their life. And I'm really glad that I am able to do that.
Absolutely. And you actually have an artistic background too. Like you went to school for it. You were going to be. Yeah, go ahead.
What I was gifted with was visual art. So I'm quite a decent painter. My dad's a decent painter. My whole entire side of my father's family are good artistically in the visual sense. But I always wanted to be a singer, but I have zero skill. I'm tone deaf. This is just never going to happen. So I guess I've always had the urge to perform, mm-hmm. but I'm good at drawing and painting, which I like doing. But to be successful at drawing and painting, you have to love doing it. You have to do it all the time. It's just not me. I just don't love it. I can't sit around painting all day. I like the motivation part of that, the motivation of love of the craft. And then I have this, you know, a political streak. And because of my artistic background, I was able to combine that with my creative side. And I think that's lacking in this sphere. I think people are a little bit dry or unless you're doing Julie Borowski does a good job because she's funny. She mm-hmm. can really merge humor and comedy with politics and really works for her. And I can do that to some extent, but I'm much better at creating art, even if it's political.
You know, one of the questions, and you brought this up with what you just said, that I wanted to ask everybody that I interview for this series is, have you always wanted to do what you're doing? And I think for a lot of people, especially for people who are my age or older, the answer is going to be no, because we never could have envisioned doing what mm-hmm. we're actually doing. But in your case, I think I'll put the question to you like this. In your current work, what was it that actually made you start? What was the catalyst?
I think generally people need three things to do their life work or their passion. They need, you know, inherent gift. They also need motivation and they need inspiration. And inspiration can come from a number of things like emotion or life experience, interaction with other people. So for me, it all came together, I guess, over 2 years ago now. So I had the experience. I had my art background, and I had my video background because I was actually in the one of the first viral videos ever on YouTube before you could monetize it or anything. I was in a video that was number one in the U.S., number one in Canada and several European countries for a whole week.
What was it?
It was a video based on the Half-Life universe, which is a video game, and I played just like this Russian girl ran around with a gun.
I've seen that. That's the video that you're talking about. What was the name of it? Escape from City 17.
Yeah. So that was fun. I wasn't solely behind that creatively. It was the Purchase Brothers who directed the video, but I was part of the creative process. I was part of the filming, part of the writing and compositing, and I even did some rotoscoping on it. And anyways, the whole process was super fun and creative, and I learned how to edit from being part of that, just being around that environment. So everything kind of came together for me at the same time, but the skill wasn't enough. I was brewing ideas. I had the script written for The Shift. I wanted to do video because I had been writing articles, but I didn't have the guts yet. And then I fell deeply in love. And then very shortly after was incredibly heartbroken. And for me, that really, you know, that was my inspiration. That was my motivation. That was my fuel. That's what got me going. And that's true for a lot of people, I think. I think a lot of creative minds, they channel some sort of tragedy, whether it's a death of a family member or an unrequited love, and they channel it and they create their work from that. Some people go to, you know, there's that stereotype of the creatives being heroin addicts and alcoholics, and mm-hmm. It's so incredibly true. Look at Edith Piaf, you know, horrible heroin addict and alcoholic. Look at Amy Winehouse. Look at Lana Del Rey. And then you can, so they had that struggle from their personal life and then medicating with all those things. And it kind of came together, making them incredibly maybe emotional beings. And because they also had a gift, they had a gift for something. They were able to turn that emotion into something beautiful, in my opinion. And you could probably argue that if they didn't have that life experience, that heartbreak, they weren't in love and devastated, they didn't have the problems with narcotics and alcohol, you could, I think, very convincingly argue that their work would not exist or be anywhere near as good.
It seems like there's a prerequisite of some kind of adversity in a lot of these cases. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I wanted to do for people in the audience, I mean, everybody has their own challenges, everybody has their own struggles, but making maybe some of those lessons useful for more people. I think that maybe not everybody has this genius or this gift that we see in so many of these artists or so many of these tortured artists, but I think people have a lot of untapped creative potential that they just haven't been able to access for one reason or another. I mean, we don't really live from, you know, K-12 schooling or the work world in environments that allow a lot of people opportunities to access it. Now, granted, there's plenty of time in life outside of doing those things. There's plenty of kids who are going through the public school system that are plenty artistic, and there's plenty of people who work 9-to-5 jobs who have plenty of time for their own artistic pursuits. But I wanted to just see if we could examine that question a little bit more, that connection between adversity and creativity. And you mentioned like some kind of, you know, emotional challenge. But
yeah,
what do you think it is about those types of experience that lead to this kind of inspired or genius work?
I think it's about feeling something in an insanely intense way. I think for, you know, you could, for some people, they hibernate instead. They get depressed and they do nothing. I think for those with a creative streak, it's incredibly self-medicating to channel that. More than ever, we have leisure time mm-hmm. in the history of the world. And those who have a natural gift for something, you know, if they have a perfect life, if they have no struggle, if they have no death, if they have no heartbreak, what are they going to write about? What are they going to reference? Where's the fuel? What's going to fuel, what's going to motivate them? And I do know some artists that, there's different approaches, right? I do know some artists that are just very meticulous about their craft. They're very thoughtful and they just work at it a lot. But that creates a certain kind of work that's, I think, very inherently different from what we're talking about. Not worse, not better, different. And probably it has an advantage because it could be steady and it could be continuously improved upon and honed. Whereas people like that I've mentioned are very self-destructive and it's not sustainable. It usually ends bad, but they're also much more famous or recognized than the people who just work really hard at it for a long time and have a steady release and output of their creativity.
Yeah, you know, I think just a couple of people who come to mind, somebody like Janis Joplin or Jimi Hendrix or Heath Ledger, and you look at their short mm-hmm. lives and the way they lived and, you know, how they treated themselves physically and mentally, and you say, or I say anyway, that doesn't really seem like somebody who really ever got stuck in a kind of comfort zone. And right. And that seems like a real death for creativity or inspired productive work generally. But obviously, I want to stress for people that there's probably other ways to break out of it besides, you know, putting yourself in such dire straits or difficult situations. Yeah. And this was a question I wanted to ask you because I know you get out a lot. You go a lot of places, you go to conventions, you see different things, you've traveled the world. You're not even originally from where you live now. You're from pretty much the other side of the world. Have those kinds of experiences, maybe just think about like your travel schedule over the last couple of years. Do you find that can be an energizing or inspiring thing if you think about coming back and then returning to the work you do? Are you in a different frame of mind after those kinds of experiences?
I know for a lot of people, their location is very inspiring. For me, that's not the case. But what travel does for me, it exposes me to individuals that inspire me. I'm very inspired by relationships. They don't have to be romantic. And I need muses. That's the simplest way to put it. I need muses. And my favorite writings that I've done I don't even remember writing them. I'm incredibly inspired by an individual and something just goes off in me. And then all of a sudden there's a script in front of me that I turn into a video, an article or a piece of work. And it's like a blackout. Mm-hmm. And travel enables me to experience things with new people or people that have inspired me. So it's not the actual travel in and of itself. It's who you're around when you're doing it, for me personally.
So you're inspired by people you know, people you interact with.
Mm-hmm.
That was definitely one of my questions. Others too, people you don't know. We've touched on a few of them and I want to get more into that in a bit, because what inspires people is definitely something that I'm interested in learning more about. But when people, you know, see what you do, when that shows up on YouTube, I wanted to talk a little bit about the process that happens before that. You know, like the seed of an idea, how it becomes something that you think can turn into an entertaining or an enlightening presentation for people, and how that is executed from start to finish.
Yeah, so as I said, my most inspired ideas kind of just appear on the, they appear. I just type it and it's done. And then it's a matter of just making the video. But you do have to, if you sit on it for too long, it's not always productive. You know, procrastination can be really good because it lets you reassess your idea and really make sure that you believe what you're going to say. And I have done that. I have sat on a project for over a year. I have had the script written. And I've sat on it for over a year to make sure that what I'm saying, I mean. And that's when it really hurts me, when people think that it's off the cuff or, you know, I didn't think it through, when in fact I've thought it through for over a year. Then that's usually the more political philosophical work. And I think people should do that with that kind of work. And it's not necessarily a bad thing to let it sit. With the creative stuff, you really have to grab it. Like, if there's a creative idea that swoops in and you have it and you get invigorized and energized to do it, you kind of have to do it right there and then in that moment, or else your motivation will die and that inspiration won't be part of your work anymore. It'll be not as good.
Yeah. You know, there's this thing too about critiquing your own work. Like, I'll think of something and I'll start to do it and then I'll think about it some more and I'll say, no, that sucks. you know, but when I first started to think about it, I was like, this is probably the best idea I've ever had. And I've actually learned, and a couple of things that I brought all the way to the end and put out for people to see, it did go through that process of self-critique where I was like, no, you know what? This isn't actually really that good, or I'm cheating here, or this whole like video that I want to make is based on a logical fallacy and I probably shouldn't put it out. But then the response was so positive that it actually has encouraged me to take more chances and to not listen to that critical voice as much. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's the thing where when you have that idea and you first encounter it, imagine other people in that position encountering it for the first time. Like when I first encountered it, I said, this is phenomenal. This is wonderful. I'm so pleased that I thought about this. Well, maybe there's a whole bunch of other people who would feel that way when they see it for the first time. They're not going to sit there and cycle through it and think about it, you know, 24 times like I am. So I think there is real value in when you have that idea that motivates you and inspires you that you should jump on it. If you have the, you know, the time and the resources, or hopefully you can make the time and the resources right away, because that has produced, you know, by and large, good results for me.
Yeah. And people like us are very hard on themselves. And it's important to keep in mind that you are allowed to change your mind, and you are allowed to realize that you were wrong, and you're allowed to take down work that you no longer believe in, or keep it up as a, you know, something to reference from your past. Mm-hmm. You should be going through an evolution of opinion. And the things that I believed in a year ago have not done a 180 or anything, but they have matured and become more nuanced. There are people I've talked to who don't read fiction. They only read nonfiction because they want to self-educate. I think that's a huge error. The best political books ever written are all fiction. That's my humble and assertive opinion on that. The reason they're successful is because, first of all, they were able to publish them without censorship because it's ambiguous or fictional enough to exist in the country they published it in, right? During the time that they published it in. Second of all, it's an entertaining read because it's fiction. Therefore, people who aren't reading it for political purposes may still and have read it, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's an important statement to make. Like, I wanted to bring up Victor Hugo. You know, he applies to our creative process, to creative process from agony, the creative process through reaction, and being a fictional political writer. And in my favorite book of all time is Les Mis. And I find myself questioning, like, would he have written this book? Would it be the same book? Would it be as good of a book if his favorite daughter didn't drown with her fiancé, which was an event that triggered a 10-year lapse in work for him? Because he was a very prolific writer, and he just stopped writing for 10 years. And then 10 years later, Les Mis. It's also wouldn't have existed, I think, if it wasn't for Napoleon III, because he used to support Napoleon III, and then he realized that he's a tyrant, and he went the other way. So it was a reaction to his own realization of political, you know, political change.
He was exiled too. I think he was in his. For people who are completely ignorant to Victor Hugo, and there might be some young people in the audience or older people in the audience who are, and that's fine. He was a 19th century French writer and poet, right? And in addition
to playwright.
Yeah, in addition to Les Misérables, he wrote The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Yeah, which is a great criticism on how people are treated within French society.
I first heard about him in Civil War class in college because he wrote a letter, basically like an open letter to the United States in 1859 in response to the John Brown incident. Are you familiar with the John Brown story? John Brown was a radical abolitionist who basically hijacked this military fort in, I can't believe I'm forgetting the name of the place. I want to say Harper's Ferry, which is in today West Virginia. And this was kind of a spark that led to the Civil War, but his cause was the abolition of slavery. So Hugo's response was, you know, I like the United States. He hated Britain. He was basically Anglophobic and had very...
That's very French of him.
Yeah. And I admired him for his Anglophobia. I thought I invented that. But he had a really positive regard for the United States most of his life. That was one of his few criticisms, was like, you're going to execute John Brown, who is this important revolutionary for this noble cause. And if you think about your traditions, America, and the hope you are for the world, for freedom, this was written in 1859, maybe reconsider your course here. So that was how I first heard of Hugo. And that was probably shortly after he wrote Les Mis. I'm not sure when he wrote The Hunchback. Might have been earlier. But
yeah, he wrote Hunchback earlier. Les Mis was a work way later in his life, after a lot of the French revolutions began. Because there were several French revolutions. So he wrote them, you know, he would have had to written the book after those occurred.
Right.
So it had to be after the Civil War in America, because they were greatly inspired by that.
So why would you cite him as a really significant artistic inspiration for you?
Because he's a conglomerate of all of these things we've been talking about, right? He has the gift, obviously. Mm. He has the motivation and dedication, because throughout his life he was a prolific writer. But again, in my opinion, his best work, his most epic work, was a result of life experience, tragedy, and political reaction. And it just wouldn't exist without those things, right? And you could be the most talented person in the world, but if you live in your bedroom and you've never experienced anything in your life, you're not going to create anything.
Yeah, you know, right before he died, actually, he was pretty much bedridden. He was sick. And one of the last trips that he went on was to see the Statue of Liberty being sent off from France.
Wow.
To the United States of America.
How romantic.
Yeah. That was one of the last times he got out of his bedroom. You know, I'm one of these people that you're talking about who has not read enough fiction. I have not.
Do it.
And had a negative attitude about reading for half of my life, you know, because of it being imposed on me. But never really got into reading fiction books. I've certainly read, you know, several. But not nearly what somebody my age should have accumulated by now.
Will you promise to read Les Misérables for me? Read it slowly. I read that book so slowly because it was such word porn for me. Mm-hmm. It's so beautifully written, and it explores morality and duty and humanity. And if I had to recommend a book to aliens about the human condition, there you go.
That's a strong endorsement, and you've provided a kind of accountability, because you'll be checking in with me.
Say, I will.
Brett, are you reading this book that I assigned? Mm-hmm. Yes. I will find a copy of the book the next time we speak, unless it's like later this week, I will have a copy of the book.
Get a good translation. There's a new translation I picked up by a woman that's been very popular in the recent years. But I'll message you the translation that I really enjoyed the first time I read it. Can we mention some more people?
Absolutely, yeah.
So another person that had a very creative, very interesting, interpretable creative process is Mary Shelley, who's the daughter of Mary Wollstonecraft, who was one of the first feminists. She died shortly after she gave birth to Mary. But Mary grew up surrounded by books, and her father was a political, philosophical intellectual, and she ran away with a poet, and she hung around with people like Lord Byron, and she was very stimulated, in a very stimulated atmosphere, which for women at that time could be argued was quite rare. You know, those kind of circles were usually occupied by male intellectuals, but because of her parents and her history, she was really exposed to all of it. And she had a child with this poet. Poet, actually, it was very scandalous. He ditched his pregnant wife to elope with Mary. And Mary's parents were never married and were generally against that current institution of marriage. They're very progressive, you know, by definition for that time. And too bad that word is tainted. Now someone's going to be triggered by me using the word progressive, but anyways. So then her child died. Her firstborn child with this poet died, I think 2 weeks after it was born. It was born premature. And I don't think she would have written Frankenstein if her child didn't die. I can't prove that. Obviously, no one can prove that. But I don't think she would have, because so many of the themes in that book are, you know, obsessing with bringing something back to life, right?
Indeed, yeah.
And it's such a, for that time, especially with such, it was such a scary, morbid book. It was, it had a very negative reaction from some people because it was so gruesome and scary and morbid. And I doubt she would have written it, not in the same way, at least, if her child didn't die. I think that sparked something in her. And then again, that intellectual circle. I know she first wrote the short draft of it when it was a rainy day and Lord Byron challenged everyone in the room to a scariest short story competition. I think that triggered it as well. But I think that trauma of losing your first child at such an early stage of life probably fixated her on a theme of death and life.
Yeah, it brings up this question of living consciously. If she knew what the genesis of that story was or not. It's like when we're examining it, knowing the story and knowing a little bit about her biography, it seems obvious, right?
Yeah.
But when she first put the pen to the paper, did she know, right? Was that a response to that trauma? It's an interesting thing to think about. It's not a question that you or I can answer,
yeah.
But it's interesting to think about how often that can happen. And is it better in the creative sense to be in touch, to be kind of inventorying what's going on inside your own head, or to be in some ways completely ignorant to it, which in most cases is certainly not better, right? Like living consciously, accepting what is and deciding what to do about it, I think is always a better course for success and happiness in life. But then you have these cases of these incredible creative geniuses. We could expand to, you know, some of the other people you mentioned, like Amy Winehouse, right? Where there it seems to be a tremendous disconnect. Now, addiction is a tricky thing for sure, between what's going on in me and what's the best way to deal with it. Right?
Yeah. I think Amy was quite conscious of, like, her Back to Black album was written in heartbreak. Like, and because a lot of the songs are about that heartbreak, I mean, she must have been conscious that the album is fueled by her heartbreak to some degree, right?
Mm-hmm.
But was she conscious that that's what made her actually sit down and write it and maybe gave it that much soul? Maybe she was, maybe she wasn't. I think in retrospect, for sure. And better or worse, I don't know, like, I'm in retrospect, my most productive year was when I was in heartbreak. And in the moment, I just remember having all this fuel in me and I had to do something with it. And I had to prove to myself that I was capable of doing it. And I think if I was happy, it wouldn't have happened, because I'm happy right now and I'm kind of like stagnating. Like I haven't made anything incredibly creative in a while. I haven't had that sit down moment where I just throw something up on the page and it's perfect. I haven't had that in a while. And it's because I've been very happy lately. And, you know, it's kind of a curse to my creative process, because I have to be like devastated to be incredibly creative. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even just with productive output, even if it's not what most people would consider creative work. I mean, I think what we do or what I do is creative because there is a process of creation in it. And
yeah,
that's the only definition it really needs. But yeah, I was really churning it out when I was newer to these ideas and really, really angry. And, you know, Barack Obama had just gotten elected and we just went through all the Ron Paul stuff.
Yeah,
I was furious. And plus I had, you know, 10 years of backed up, unable to be spoken frustrations about what I had gone through in my career in schooling. So much of it just blurted out very quickly, you know, and then as time goes by, I've kind of adjusted to those realities. I live in many ways a more comfortable existence than I did then. Yeah, it seems like the fire goes out sometimes. And that was part of the exploration this month was getting it back, because I know what I've done before. I don't think anybody just runs out. If you have the capacity to do work that you believe is high quality, you know, when you self-evaluate it, I really think you have the capacity to do more of it, to do it.
Sure? Yeah.
To do it endlessly. And maybe just something has to change to re-trigger that, you know, creative flow.
I'll bring up Lana for this, because Lana Del Rey, I think, I watched an interview with her, and she says she keeps writing this, different songs about the same guy. Mm-hmm. And, like, she's in a new release. I think she's married, actually. But I guess even during her marriage, she still writes some of her songs about the same guy. And that's okay, because it looks like she's going back to that place of pain, and it's fueling her creativity. And I've done that too before. Like, I'm not heartbroken anymore. I'm not in love with this person. But I have gone back to that place when I needed to. And you can't keep going back to the same place, because I think it does die down. You need something new to spark you. And that's the trick. Like, even people with capacity, like, the capacity will never go away. But yeah, what if you, like, Brett, what if you're like, life gets real good? Like, you don't, what if you win the lottery and you just go on a perpetual vacation, and you are disinterested in the politics of America because you can live in Bali? Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. That is a huge potential for stagnating indefinitely.
Indeed it is. I would like to think that my first order of business would be to hire a creative team and bring them into the boardroom and say, guys, I'm very, very rich and very, very comfortable, and you shouldn't count on me for much, but I still am on this mission that is important to me. I just don't have that capacity to generate creative ideas anymore. So that's up to you. Maybe I could get them from, television writers. I don't know. No, I don't know, Julia. It's a good question. I'd like to think I would do that.
Yeah, possible. And I mean, it takes a special kind of person to just keep going. Like, look at Alex Jones. Holy moly, that guy. Like, that, even with all his wealth, all his gained popularity, and all his potential leisure time, which he does take more time off now than he did before, which is fully granted to him, the dude still, like, produces so much. You know, he's on that show almost every day. He's like, going and going and going. He always has something to say, right? Mm-hmm. And it's just incredible to me. I mean, love him or hate him, that doesn't matter for the point I'm making. It's just completely incredible. He's an entire team, like, and he still has the capacity to just continue, just chug along and stay entertaining, whether you love him or hate him. And that, my friend, was something he was simply born with.
Indeed. Yeah. And that actually is a great segue to the last question. We talked when you were on the show before about your video, The Shift. One of the things that you bring up in that video as a real concern is what you call the insult of equality, right? So
trigger warning.
Yeah. Here it comes. We are led to believe that any person can be anything that he or she wishes to be. We have both argued that this is not the case. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to creativity, outside of traumatic brain injury or other medical obstacles, do you believe that each person has the capacity for meaningful creative work?
No.
Great.
Just like not every person has the capacity to solve incredibly complex mathematical equations or come up with new breakthroughs in cryptography. This is something that is beneficial to society to acknowledge. Just imagine if I had that progressive mindset where I believed that I could do anything I put my mind to. I would have wasted the best years of my life trying to be a singer. Mm-hmm. Wasted and embarrassed myself. Completely destroyed my self-esteem, probably spent lots of money and, more importantly, time on something that will never be realized. Thank God I am not from that school of thought, and I know my limitations, and I have decided to do things that I am somewhat decent at, that I know that I can become better at, and that I have the inclination I am inclined to already be good at. Some people should be lawyers.
Yeah,
not painters. Not painters. Okay. And I think whether it's inherited, which I think it is, my father was a painter, my cousin is a brilliant artist, my sister is a brilliant artist. I think some of it's inherited. It's so scary for people to admit that they're not in control of their own destiny. But a lot of the time, your genetic makeup or the environment you were brought up in really sets your path in stone. And what you do on that path is where your free will comes in. But free will is still limited by some things.
So don't you think creativity, and you talk about, like, yes, you would have failed in this one creative pursuit. You would have destroyed your self-image. You would have been miserable, or you would have taken the other track of finding out who is keeping you down, you know?
Yeah, but general creativity.
Right, but so you channeled it into mostly another creative pursuit.
Yeah.
Your thoughts, your energy, your efforts, your passions. Mm-hmm. So creativity is also different than writing some kind of code or being some kind of mathematician, isn't it? Like, that's well, a kind
it's
of...
It's a different kind of creativity, okay. Right? So, yeah, let's be precise with language. I think programmers are very creative. They're programmers to just write code for, like, companies that they're told what to do and they do it. They have the skill set. Then there's programmers who have to, you know, programming is just coming up with solutions to problems. And you have to have some sort of creativity to do that on your own, right? Mm-hmm. Some of the most creative people I've ever met were programmers. And that's their field. I think you have to be pretty creative to come up with Bitcoin.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay? But I mean, I was using the example of programmers as, you know, people often associate that with a high intelligence level, right? So if we talk about, well, not everybody could be a lawyer. Or not everybody could be a mathematician, but
everyone can learn how to program, but not well.
All right.
Just like painting. Everyone can learn how to paint, but not everyone's going to do it well. I've known people from high school who decided to start oil painting in high school. And to this day, they're oil painting all the time and trying to be an artist. And they're still crap because they don't have talent. I know people, my cousin, for example, she's a veterinarian. Even she's one of the most gifted artists I've ever met. She'll imagine a scene and just put it on paper with a pen doodle and it'll be a masterpiece. And she's chosen to be a veterinarian. And she has these beautiful drawings like scattered around her house, just like crumpled up. It's insane. But she has talent. Because she has talent, she's able to do that.
The reason why I asked that question is that as the month goes on, I'm going to encourage people to explore their creative capacities. And I would argue that most people, I think certainly the people in this audience, some of them might be highly creative, but I bet there's also lots of people who are listening who have untapped potential. And those are the people that I'm really talking to. I'm sure there are people who have, I think that there was a Victor Hugo quote. Wait a minute. There's a great Victor Hugo quote. I don't know. I'm not going to
search
for it now.
I'll talk.
I'll never find it, but I'm going to paraphrase it.
Look it up.
All right.
Yeah, untapped creativity. I don't want the things I'm saying to be interpreted as dig your grave and lay in it. Because, of course, a lot of people are very good at things that they didn't know they were good at. Maybe you grew up in a family that only valued the hard sciences, but you were gifted from birth with an incredible creative streak, which has been bashed down by expectations. That definitely happens.
I think that happened a lot throughout history, for sure.
Right. And especially in the school system.
Mm-hmm.
And I wholeheartedly encourage people to try and tap into that. What I do discourage is being creative as a default for not having anything else to do, because I'll give the example of going to art school. I was in art programs with people who should not be there at all. And if it was a math program, they would have failed because it's subjective arts and we have this PC culture where you can't critique anybody's creative outputs anymore. They, you know, got a degree. Mm-hmm. And that pisses me off a lot because people who are actually talented are graduating at the same rate as people who aren't. And that reduces their degree to being completely meaningless, while a degree in engineering, high-level engineering, is never going to be meaningless because everyone else dropped out because they weren't smart enough or dedicated enough to achieve it, right?
Right.
But that's the problem with the creative work. It is subjective, although I think there is a standard of objective quality, right? There's still a standard of, for me at least, someone just throwing paint on a canvas without any thought or context is not a great artist. And people think just because Jack the Dripper did it, He did it in a context where it was the first time anyone's ever done that. And he did it with meticulous, hardworking precision in some ways. Although it's chaotic, there was a meticulous nature to his artistic creations. And then I go to university, when that kind of style has been, you know, done and moved on from, people are still doing that and they think that they're just as good.
And people like that, there's the general kind of person that you're talking about gets emboldened by this false praise or these high marks that you don't feel like they earned, and they become these starving artist types because they can't.
Yeah, get a job.
Yeah. They can't make money doing the work they do, because I think you're right. There's definitely an objective standard for quality. There certainly is in what I do. I was with Mark Edge this weekend from Free Talk Live. And I was berating him about, like, all the things that Free Talk Live, I said, if I had your resources, I would be doing this, I would be doing that, I'd be doing this, I'd be doing that. And what I said was, there's a lot of things that I don't do, because when they're done right now, they won't look how I want them to look, because I don't have the resources or the skills to make them look that way. So I'm very aware that there's an objective standard for what I do of quality. And that's a limitation that obviously, as time goes by, I want to overcome. But I do agree that there is a prerequisite for meaningful is such a subjective word, but there is a prerequisite for creative work, and I think intelligence is a big part of it. And the Victor Hugo quote that I got all excited about a couple minutes ago was, reason is intelligence taking exercise, imagination is intelligence with an erection. That was why I remember the quote. But if you think about that, that makes sense, right? There is an application of creative energy that comes from intelligence. I think that's really important. From having keen powers of observation about what's going on around you, and then being able to turn it into something that is your own.
I think you said it well. A child drawing a picture of a dog, I think we misuse the word creative. Is that creative? That's taking sensory input and reflecting it on a piece of paper. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is important to hone craft. You do that for years until you can draw from your mind and be creative. Or you can composite new, you can create something unique on a canvas. It's the whole problem of people used to draw something like hyperrealism or hyperrealism. That's dead now because we have photography, right? So art has become something much more subjective due to that fact. Because it's not enough to just draw a landscape anymore. It's not interesting anymore. It has to be something way beyond that. And this, you know, that's an evolution of creativity. And you can see this with political thought as well, with political commentary. So before, people would often just reflect what's happening, right, through just newspapers or a basic news broadcast. Look at where we've come. Now it's commentary and humor and reaction and social media memes, and all of these creative things evolve. You can't do them in a way that they used to be done anymore, because you just don't live during that time. And people think that you can, but I think the most creative thing you can do is do something in a very unique way, right? And that's very difficult to do because so many things have already been done.
Yeah, that is the trick. And do things differently, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they used to slap that creativity label on us all the time when I was in school. Everyone said I was creative when I traced my hand and then colored it to look like a turkey, you know? But then a month later, during the Christmas play, when I was playing one of the three wise men and I dropped my staff and I announced to the crowd, this is stupid, and I walked off the stage, everyone just thought I was bad. But I thought that was a way better move.
Yeah.
I don't know if
that was more creative.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But I didn't get credit for that, which was way more out of the bounds. I mean, I was tracing my own hand, for heaven's sake, with the turkey. That's not creativity. But walking out of a live play and calling it stupid, criticizing, being the critic of the Christmas play as I walked off the stage. I don't know why we were doing
a
religious
art.
Yeah, I don't know why we were doing a religious themed play, because it was like the nativity scene.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just standing there as one of the wise men, and I said, I've had it. This is not for me. This, I don't think you people should even be watching this. I was maybe like six. So, final question. What's your favorite creation? Of yours, that other people could see?
Well, that's easy enough. I was like, oh my God, of all time. Well, The Shift is one of them, but we already discussed that. Mm-hmm. So my favorite one is The State Has Become Our God. And I just like the poeticism of it. And it was one of those times where I blacked out and just wrote it. I was in this room and I blacked out and all of a sudden it was in front of me.
The state is a collection of ideas propagated and implemented not by force, but as a result of our compliance. Human compliance occurs naturally, and like most natural resources, it can be cultivated and grown. So here we are, stuck in the feedback loop of watchful prevention. The worship of what-ifs, the assumption of better judgment, the age-old tool of good intentions, the ageless logic of for the greater good, the humble attitude of we do what we must because we can. Passive protocols, conveyor belt screenings, systematic surveillance, background checks, foreground balances, aerial scans, ground drills, the security of security. And how do they reconcile their failures? Why, failure is the greatest tool of all, for it shows the public that the state can do better, that we need more paper and ink, that we need more policy makers, that we need more people behind podiums and microphones, that we need better people to solve the problem of people.
Why would you cite that as your favorite, aside from The Shift?
It encompasses a lot of the current issues of today. It really captures everything in one not long-winded poem. And I think it's quite beautiful in its own sense. Yeah.
I think I've seen it. It's short, too. It's like 5 or 6 minutes, right?
Yeah, it's... It kind of, it creates a responsibility of the individual, right? Mm-hmm. So instead of vilifying this abstract idea of being oppressed by this abstract idea, right? It includes you in it. You are this abstract idea by your compliance to it.
Well, I recommend that people watch that video and really dig into your channel, because even just by watching the subscribe video, you can tell, and this was one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you in this series. You can tell
that video. I'm so torn about that video.
No, but I'll tell you, listen, it is, here's ideas, libertarians and anarchists or whatever you want to call yourself, as long as you're in this general, you know, circle mm-hmm. of ideas. Here are ideas you're familiar with, but you're going to hear about them and really be encouraged to think about them in entirely different ways. You know,
that's what you get from my trailer.
That's what I get from your trailer. That this might be familiar territory intellectually, but this is something different. And everything has such, I think this wasn't really something that we talked about during
the
show.
That makes me so happy. I want to like make you a cake.
it's a really great trailer. And when I first saw it, I had only met you that once when we did the roast together. So
yeah.
I checked it out and, I was hooked. I subscribed right away.
I'm so glad to hear that, because I'm so up and down on that trailer. Like, I love it, but I hate it. I probably just hate it because it's me. No one likes to watch themselves on camera or hear their own voice. But it is honest. It is a genuine, honest presentation of my channel. So I've kept it. I have kept it because of that.
Yeah, I just contrast it to mine, which is basically like, here's what our channel is. This is what we do. And it's all very, very clear. But
you're very approachable.
I'm very approachable.
Yeah, your channel is very approachable. Your show is very approachable. And that's why I like it. And that's why people who aren't libertarians or anarchists by definition aren't in this space. They like it too, because it's more than that, you know?
Yeah. But I found with yours, there were a couple times just in that video where I said, what does that mean? But not like, I don't understand what that means. It's like,
yeah.
I want to learn what that means, you know, because I'm not sure I fully understand it. So I really encourage people to go and subscribe to Brave the World.
I will give myself credit. I'm good at the one-liners. I am. At Brave the World, follow me on Twitter. My website's bravetheworld.com. My channel is Brave the World. Check it out. And if you hate me, you'll probably watch a different video and love me. So give it a shot.
Excellent. So thank you so much for participating in this series with me. And I will... find a reason, I'm sure, to have you on the show again in the near future. I look forward to it.
Yes, I'm brewing some new content, so we'll be back.
Absolutely. Thanks again, Julia.
Okay. Always a pleasure.
All right, we did it.
Yay!